This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Welcome to A Conversation with History. I'm Harry Kreisler of the Institute of International Studies. Our guest today is Philip Pettit, who is the L.S. Rockefeller University Professor of Politics and Human Values at Princeton and Distinguished Professor of Philosophy at the Australian National University. He works in moral and political theory and on issues in philosophy of the mind and metaphysics. His most recent book is Just Freedom, A Moral Compass for a Complex World. He is giving the Tanner Lectures on Human Values at Berkeley in 2015. Professor Pettit, welcome to Berkeley.
Thank you.
Where were you born and raised?
A small town in the west of Ireland, Ballygar. It's in County Galway, directly across from Dublin.
And looking back, how do you see your parents shaping your perspective on the world?
I was raised in quite a religious family, not sectarian, I must say, Catholic, but very, very encompassing, very ecumenical in attitude. And I think it was through probably, you know, religious themes that I came to philosophy, an interest in, you know, the big questions, which were obviously always put before you about free will, about good and evil, about the existence of God, about an afterlife. And these issues clearly, for anyone with that background, are going to be very, very prominent. I went through standard schooling where actually my interests were mainly mathematics and classics, and went to university intending to do one or the other, and in university discovered the possibility of doing philosophy, which I must say really excited me. I thought the idea of being able to spend time thinking about these big questions, on which I had, after all, just received religious instruction, so to speak, but thinking for myself, I found that really heady almost. I remember the excitement when I was 18, you know, that I could transfer to this subject. So I did.
And was the leap from viewing this as religious topics to really viewing them in a secular way, was that difficult for you or just flowed naturally?
I think it really, in my own case, it occurred mainly because of reading Sartre. I became very enthusiastic about his work. I didn't for a moment believe it. I mean, coming from my background, after all, here was someone, you know, there was no God. There was certainly free will, but it was of a very extraordinary sort, very different from the sort, for example, that Aquinas would have articulated that I would have learned. But it was so exciting reading Sartre, because here was somebody who dealt with the big questions, who had different views from me that I've been raised in on almost every question, who developed them in this wonderfully systematic way, and who also gave literary expression to them in both his plays, which I think are still extraordinarily good, and his novels, which are maybe not so good as novels, but they still give a vividness to these themes. For me, that was probably the most exciting intellectual event in university, that I discovered Sartre, and I actually wrote an undergraduate senior thesis on Sartre. I was completely converted to philosophy from then on.
In either before university or during university, were you engaged in politics at all?
No, not immediate, not as an undergraduate, but I had a rather unusual background. At the same time, when I went to university, I was also in seminary, training with the idea of becoming a Catholic priest. So reading Sartre, for example, I had to actually get the permission of my bishop to read Sartre, because Sartre was on the index of forbidden books within the Catholic Church. But I left the priesthood. I mean, I left that strand about 3 years in. I then did a master's degree, which was rather different from the Sartre work, on basically the early Bertrand Russell and G.E. Moore and their thought. I then, amazingly, this was 1968. There were jobs aplenty, especially in Ireland and England, because all these new universities had been created. And so I think my MA examiners, both my external examiners, offered me a post. So I was teaching at 21, I think I started teaching. So I was junior faculty when the big revolts happened in university, in Berkeley, of course, but also in Europe, including in Ireland. So I was teaching at University College in Dublin in 1969, March 69, when the student unrest began. And I did actually get quite involved in that as a sort of junior faculty. In the end, I mean, I was one of the faculty who was, you know, pro-students, as you'd expect at that age and time, and I suppose given my own inclinations. But the first book I actually published, I think it's the only book that's ever been in a bestseller list, actually, was a collection of pieces by what people described as radical faculty and students, which I edited in 1969 in Ireland. It was published under the title, somewhat embarrassing now, as The Gentle Revolution. But it was sort of an Irish version of Paris, Les Événements, and of what was happening in Berkeley at the time. Probably a more, you know, modulated, moderate version than what was happening elsewhere.
We're going to talk about your book on freedom shortly, but I'm curious, to what extent did the experience in the Catholic Church on the one hand and the student activism on the other, did they point you in the direction of this focus on freedom?
I think probably the exposure to Sartre very early on put the theme of freedom very, very prominently in my mind. I mean, Sartre was focused, of course, and I've always been interested in that too, on what we would call free will, or on the freedom of an agent to go with his or her judgment rather than desires and so on. But a problem for him, and it comes out in his work as it develops, is how to translate that into a political ideal of freedom. And that always concerned me. So that theme was there from very early on. That was it was probably 15 or 20 years later before I began writing very explicitly about the political ideal of freedom.
I like to ask my guests about the skills and temperament that they think are prerequisites or helpful in the career that they've chosen. So what do you see as important skills for a philosopher?
Obsession. I think the capacity to become completely obsessed with a problem or with an idea, so that, you know, you don't just read about it, you don't just write about it, but you think about it. It's the first thing that comes to mind when you have a spare moment, you know, on the doctor's surgery or on the bed in the morning or whatever it might be, just to be able to return to the thought or the idea or the problem and think it quietly through and keep your mind focused on it. So I think that it's really a sort of obsession, I think. I'd have to say that it's like riding the tiger, in Mao's phrase. You know, I think you've got to have that obsession and live with it to... At least that's what I found that works in my own case in dealing with a problem. It's always that obsession that's pushed me towards publishing something or writing something that I may, of course, be more or less happy with, but that's certainly, I think, a driving force.
And there must also be the ability to transcend frustration, because it must be very frustrating when you're alone trying to grapple with a problem.
Right. Well, I think you probably have to, in order to concentrate in the way I'm talking about, I guess, you know, if it's in the doctor's surgery or on the bus or whatever it might be, you have to be able to put other things that are on your mind aside, you know, not to be distracted. You certainly have to have that capacity. I think that when you talk about frustration, it's true that philosophical problems, any problems really, as you think through them, are often very, very frustrating. You know, when you're stuck with the problem, you can't see a way out, you've tried this, you've tried that, you've tried the other, you've read the background literature, you find yourself just staring at a blank page of paper, you know, when you're trying to set down your ideas about it. I do find that very frustrating. And if I think I've hit a blank wall, it really bothers me. I guess everybody experiences this, that you've just got to live with it.
In your work, especially the book on freedom, which we'll talk about in a minute, there also seems in your work to be a sense of the history of the problem and how it has evolved over time in the work of philosophers that have preceded you. Talk a little about that, because the history of philosophical thought seems to be very important.
Well, if I can just do that by talking about my own history in a way. After University College Dublin, at least after 3 or 4 years there, I was lucky enough to get a research fellowship at a college in Cambridge, Trinity Hall in Cambridge, England. And there I came to be very close to people who work in the history of ideas, such as Quentin Skinner and Richard Tuck. Through them, I must say, I became intrigued with the history of the subject, and they concentrate, it was often called the Cambridge Contextualist School, on the context of historical ideas. I became quite fascinated with that, but on the other hand, I sort of felt this wasn't for me, that I really wasn't cut out to be a historian of that kind, that I thought that I'd find it impossible to get interested in reading not just the greats, but the less great people that the greats had read and the even less great people that they had read, you know, to know the full context. So my response actually was to go more theoretical and in my philosophical thinking. And it really was only 10 or 15 years later that I think I rediscovered the enthusiasm for connecting with the history, but that had laid the foundation. And I think I did so because of realizing that with new technologies, you could now access the historical texts. For example, you could take a word, you know, and do a search, you know, through the digital library of someone like Hobbes or any thinker, and immediately be able to get these sources and see how you describe it. So you, in other words, you are now getting for cheap skills that 20 years previously would have required months and years of work. I think when that happened, my historical interest sort of came back to life and began to connect with the philosophical thought.
Before we talk about freedom, I have one other question for you, and that is your sense of theory and practice. You've said in an interview that you thought it was a two-way street. I know that you were part of an experiment, which we'll talk about later, on freedom, but talk a little about that interface. What in your background made you sensitive to that? Was it the student movement that you were discussing earlier?
Honestly, I don't know, really. I think what is true that I've always felt, in particular with political philosophy, to a good extent in other areas perhaps too, but in political philosophy, that if you are really trying to think through both, you know, the nature of our institutions, how we should think about them, the values that are inherent in them sometimes, the ways in which they fail those values, the ways in which they might be improved, that there's something, I don't know, irresponsible. I mean, that's too harsh a word, but there's something that I don't find to my taste in sort of then going away and thinking about, so to speak, utopia, thinking about an abstract ideal world, rather than thinking about where we can get to from where we are in our actual institutions. Now, of course, in order to do that, I think it's very, very useful to have a sense of how those institutions work. And before, I know you want to talk about Spain and my involvement there, which I'll happily do, but long before that, I'd actually been asked to do a review of the Australian Capital Territory. I worked full-time at the Australian National University at the time. It was 1997. And there was a review of self-government in that area, the Australian Capital Territory. It's like DC, Australia's DC. Self-government had been brought in 10 years previously in 1987. And I was asked to review how it had worked. It was out of the blue. It was just due to the fact that some politicians had known me personally and knew about my interests. And I took, you know, 6 months or something off academic work. And I chaired this very small committee with two really quite outstanding public servants, amazingly knowledgeable public servants. And I spent that 6 months really, apart from the time spent writing and thinking and so on and reading, I spent a lot of it just in and around the corridors of a very small, you know, political unit. But The interesting thing is political units, they work very similarly, even at different scales. I felt that was, for me, a revelation. I felt I really now had a sense of how government can work in the different branches, the interactions and the constraints and the ideals that are important to keep in place, and the ways in which they're likely always to go off track, you know, with the system becoming distorted or even corrupted in various ways. So that I think made a real connection with practice. And no doubt my student days may, or at least my days as a young faculty in University College Dublin may have been, because I was involved in wider politics in Ireland, so that may also have contributed to that interest.
Interestingly, what was the platform on which you did this work? By that I mean you clearly weren't examining these government units for their economic efficiency. I mean, you didn't come there as an economist. Did you come there as somebody with a set of values, who had thought about values and were looking at these units from that perspective?
No, actually, I came with a fairly open mind, because the remit I was given was a very open remit to, after all, this territory had been run by the federal government, by a branch of the federal government over, you know, the previous 60, 70 years. And this was really quite novel, that you had an electoral system, you had a parliament, you had an executive. So what I found myself doing was looking at the structure of parliament and of the executive, how they related to one another, how the electoral, the members of the legislature related to their constituencies, how the constituencies were drawn. One thing that really came to my mind strongly was the relationship between this system and the Westminster system on the one hand, which is the dominant paradigm in Australia, of course, and the Washington system on the other. Because it turned out that in this area, in Canberra, basically, the Australian Capital Territory, it turns out that the government is really very rarely, at least then, was rarely controlled by a single party. So in order to get government, in order for those elected to the legislature to elect in turn a functioning, reliable, stable executive, they had to take people from different parties and independents and so on. And now that looks much more Washington-like than it does, the single-party type government that you get typically in Westminster. I found that quite fascinating. And I found the talking to people about the tensions that they experienced in office between satisfying their constituents and satisfying the press gallery and satisfying their colleagues in caucus in the party and in government, I found that extraordinarily interesting. I mean, it was it gave me an insight into, at least I think it gave me an insight into how government works, even though at a very small scale, that I found really drove me, stimulating, you know.
Mm-hmm. So your book is called Just Freedom, A Moral Compass for a Complex World. I'll show that. So let's talk about that book and what led you to undertake it, first of all, and how long did it take you to write it?
Well, if I could say, the book is an expression of a way of thinking about politics, which people sometimes call civic republican and sometimes nowadays neo-republican. And I had really chanced upon this tradition and connected with it in articulating my own ideas back in the 1990s. So I'd published a book called Republicanism in 1997. Probably not the best title given an American audience, because it suggests that it was republicanism in the GOP sense, where it's not really. It's civic republicanism, much more traditional sort of way of thinking. We can come to that in a moment. And over the years between 1997 and when this was published in 2014, I'd obviously been involved in various enterprises related to this republican tradition of thinking. And I know you want to bring me back to one such enterprise in particular. This book basically was intended as a book that would make the approach accessible to a wider audience than just scholars or even university students. So how I came to it, that was back in the 90s that I, so to speak, came to the idea, this way of thinking about freedom. Two roads, really, to the idea in my own case. One, I was thinking quite abstractly or theoretically. about how we should conceive of freedom politically if we grant that it's impossible that we should ever live in a solitary world, that we are essentially a social species. We live, clearly, there's no possibility for any one of us of living independently of others. Now, the tradition, in some ways, of thinking about freedom suggested you'd be perfectly free if you lived in a solitary universe. You know, you lived in the state of nature, all alone, no one to get in your way. You were perfectly free. I think that's, when I say the tradition, that's a way of thinking about freedom. That's certainly in the literature and has long been there. I was thinking about, well, look, suppose the solitary condition isn't even a possibility, and you want to think about what does freedom mean if it's got to be something that you can enjoy in the presence of other people, including other people who are bound to get in your way in various ways. And I'd begun to think that, well, perhaps we should think of it as a sort of status that we have vis-a-vis others, that we're free when we're given a space where we can act according to our own wishes, and where other people are not entitled to interfere in that space. And it's not just that they don't actually interfere in that space, but they're blocked from interfering in that space. So it's not just, for example, that I can act as I wish, say, for example, in reading whatever I wish, because you, who could stop me, really rather likes the idea of my reading whatever I wish. But should you turn against me, you would stop me. I wouldn't enjoy freedom in that status sense if I depended on your permission for being able to read what I wished. I need to have that, so to speak, protected and secured against the goodwill of others. So I was thinking in that broad way, and then somebody said to me, actually somebody who did his PhD in Berkeley in History of Ideas, said to me that I should perhaps look at some work of Quentin Skinner's, my friend from Cambridge days, which I did. And he led me to read the long tradition of what's often called Republican thought, from Rome through the Middle Ages, through the Renaissance, through, you know, the Dutch Republic, the English Republic in the 17th century, and of course the American and French republics in the 18th century in particular. And I found in these texts a way of thinking about freedom. I felt that it was exactly the one that I was nudging or finding my way loosely towards. So on that way of thinking about freedom, in order to be free in relation to other people, it has to be the case not just that they don't get in your way, but that they're stopped, they're not able to get in your way. So in an image that I use in Just Freedom, this particular book, to illustrate the idea, I ask people to think about the relationship between Torvald and Nora, the two protagonists of A Doll's House, Ibsen's famous play, where Torvald, the husband, a young banker, has, of course, all the legal and social and cultural rights and powers vis-a-vis Nora, his young wife, but he totally dotes on her, worships the ground she walks on, and gives her, as you might say, carte blanche, so she can act exactly as she wishes. So the question I ask is, should we regard Nora as enjoying freedom in relation to Torvald? Well, now, the very striking thing is that in terms of the Roman and the neo-Roman, the long Republican way of thinking about freedom, the way of thinking about freedom that the founders in America certainly celebrated, you could not say that Nora enjoyed freedom, because while Nora did whatever she wished within a certain range, she always did it implicitly by permission of Torvald. She depended on his goodwill. So even though he didn't interfere, even though she had carte blanche, she had freedom as non-interference, she still had a dominus in the Roman term, a lord or a master in her life. So she enjoyed non-interference, but she did not enjoy non-domination. Torvald was a master, although a sweet master, a kind master, you know, in the old term, but still a master. And that's really the core idea in this civic or older Republican way of thinking about freedom, that you've got to not be subject to the mastery of others.
As you talk about this in your book, it's very clear that this is a structural theory. And often when you're looking at structures, the insight is not visible to the person who's not really thinking through the issue. So Nora does appear to be free, but it's only by analyzing the structure of the situation, and you do that throughout the work, that the true power relationship is revealed. Is that fair?
That is absolutely fair, because, as you say, freedom on this way of conceiving of things is a function not just of the actions of other people, but of the powers at the disposal of other people. So if you exist as someone who is relatively powerless in relation to others, where others have a power of interfering, even if they don't actually interfere, the very fact of their having those powers and you're not having any, so to speak, countervailing power, any anti-power, as you might call it, means that you always live really at their mercy. You're exposed to their interference, should they wish to interfere. Of course, you're going to know this in general, in most cases, and so that's also going to put in place a motive to defer, to keep the powerful free, you know, to bend the knee in the old terms, you know, to tug the forelock if you have one, or tip the cap, you know, to kowtow. These are all words in this tradition, you know, to fawn and to toady. This is what you're going to be motivated to do in relation to others if you exist, as you say, within that structural sort of scenario where the others have got the power and you don't have it.
You make an important distinction in American culture. It sounds like you're close to libertarianism, but you're making the point, no, that's not the case, because your insight is in a way more powerful about where freedom lies. So what is it about libertarianism that you disagree with?
Well, at the basic level, in the conception of freedom itself, the purely abstract level. So on the libertarian understanding of freedom, you're free so long as you're free in a given choice. Take a particular choice, like what to read, you know, where to travel, what job to take up. You're free insofar as no one actually interferes with you on the libertarian conception. On the older Republican conception, in order to be free, it has to be the case that you are protected against those sorts, secure against those sorts of interferences. I mean, I mentioned earlier that I believe there's a real rupture in the history of freedom, and it occurs, ironically, about the time of the American Revolution. The heroes of the American Revolution and their, for example, supporters in England, such as Joseph Priestley, the chemist, or Richard Price, the mathematician, who are voluble supporters of the Americans, they all use the notion of freedom I've been talking about. So, for example, Price says at one point, he says that someone who's subject to a master, no matter how kindly a master, is not free insofar as he still depends on the goodwill of that master. And he says the same is true of a community. And he suggests that that's what's true about the American colonists, the white American colonists, of course, in relation to Westminster. Again, Joseph Priestley says, what is it that the Americans complain of? And he says, it's not that the British or the Westminster Parliament are taking taking very much from them in tax. They're only taking one penny, he suggests. But it's that Westminster Parliament claims the power to take their last penny. So what they're doing is they're imagining the relationship between London and the American colonies of the time as the relationship between a master and a servant. And they're saying, we're not free because London is claiming the position of a master. Remember in 1766, when London, the Parliament, had lifted the Stamp Act, had withdrawn that particular tax, had been very nice about it, so to speak, had been a really kindly master. They added the Declaratory Act that said, of course, we insist that we have the power and the right, should we wish, to impose this sort of text, this sort of tax. So what they're claiming is precisely that they have the powers. And the Americans immediately react by saying, we're not free. if these people claim their powers. And they're using the very idea of freedom that had been popular in England, in the European tradition. It goes right back to the Romans, the idea that you're not free if you're subject to somebody else's goodwill. They as a community are not free because they're subject to the goodwill now of Westminster, which has claimed that it has this power, should it wish to impose any tax or any law that it wanted to impose on the Americans. So what happens in England at this point is that the defenders of the English cause begin to introduce a new way of thinking about freedom. And it becomes very visible in particular in a pamphlet published in 1776 by someone called John Lind. And it's called Three Letters to Dr. Price. Dr. Price is Richard Price, the one who had supported the Americans running the Gentle Master theme. And in that document, Lind, it's a pamphlet really, in support of the British government. In that document, he says, what is freedom? And he amazingly, you know, breaks with the long tradition. And he says, well, to be free is just to be not constrained or restrained. So if you're not restrained or restrained, you're free. And if you are, you're not free. And then he says, well, that means that the law always makes you unfree. To the extent to which you're subject to law, you're unfree. That was very different from the older view, which said law was the protection against others that actually made you free. So even John Locke was part of that tradition. To be free was to enjoy the protection of the law, so you got your area where you could act according to your own will, regardless of what you wanted to do and regardless of what others wanted you to do. Now what he's saying is law is actually the enemy of freedom. And he then goes on to say, well, what's the complaint of the Americans? Because we in England live under a law that restrains us, and you in America live under a law that restrains you. But what's the difference between us? And why do you say you're not free and we are free in England? It's a very clever argument. He's a footnote in that book in which he says, this way of thinking about freedom, I derive from a very good friend, a worthy and ingenious friend, he describes him, but doesn't name him. Turns out the friend had actually complained to Lind about the fact that he was using this way of thinking about freedom, which he, the friend, claimed to have invented. He said, it came to me as a kind of invention some 6 months hence. That friend was Jeremy Bentham. Really extraordinary sort of coincidence, because Bentham, of course, becomes the great theorist of law in the English tradition and is amazingly influential. The great utilitarian, of course, and a reformer. But he introduces this new way of thinking about freedom, whereby it just requires that you're not interfered with. It doesn't matter about the power or the structure, as you're saying. And that then becomes the centerpiece of the new classical liberal views that appear in the early 19th century, the early 1800s.
These examples of the American Revolution point to the fact that if you're going to come up with a powerful definition of freedom, you have to articulate it with regard to several domains, which you do.
Yes.
So freedom is that state where you're free of domination, where there's no domination, but it has to apply with your relationship to others, with other people, situated as you are. It has to apply in the relationship of people to the government and also the relationship between states. So the examples you just showed from the American, that was the germination of this idea that it couldn't just be in one domain.
Yes. I think of, you know, political philosophy, political theory as having really three domains of concern. And this notion of freedom we're talking about has implications in each of those domains. So just the three you mentioned, let's think about the first as the social domain, the domain in which people relate to their fellow citizens, let's suppose, within a given country. Think of that as the social domain. The second domain is, you might think of it as the political domain, which is not the relationship between citizens and one another, but the relationship between the citizenry as a whole and their government. And then, of course, the third domain is the relationship between different societies, mediated usually in the relationships between the governments of the different societies. Now, I think that the civic republican ideal of freedom as non-domination was traditionally used in all of these domains, actually, and that there is much to be said for rethinking our ways of doing politics and our policies and so on by looking at the ramifications or implications of this ideal in those three domains. You might think of the first as a domain of social justice, you know, establishing a relationship between citizens in social life such that each of them can enjoy freedom in relation to other citizens. The second domain of citizenry to government you think of as the domain of political justice, that you want the citizenry as a whole, each considered as equal, of course, to enjoy a relationship with their government such that they are not dominated by their government. And in that sense, they enjoy political justice. And then in relationship between different societies, I think the ideal of freedom as non-domination gives us a very nice line into thinking about international relations and about the ways in which societies should relate to one another in the international forum, ideally enabling each society, or at least each society that is itself self-governing and democratic, there isn't an oppressive government, not to be dominated by other societies, and not, of course, to be dominated by other international bodies like multinational corporations, or for that matter, churches, or, of course, international agencies.
Mm-hmm. You have a brief phrase to sum up the realization of freedom in each of those domains. For social justice, it's the eyeball test.
The eyeball test, yes.
Explain that.
Well, in order to make vivid in this book, In Just Freedom, the ramifications of the notion of freedom in each of these areas, I suggest a sort of a rough and ready test for determining whether people are enjoying freedom in any of these three domains. And in the social domain, but this is not my invention, actually. You find this in the 17th century. In the social domain, a good test of whether people really enjoy freedom in relation to one another under the organization of the state and the economy and the law and so on, is whether people are able to look one another in the eye without reason for fear or deference. They can, in the old language, stand on their own two feet, you know, and stand equal on a par with others. Now, I think we all know, and that's why I say it's a rough and ready test, but it's an applicable test. We know when we live in a situation where you're really not able to look others in the eye. So, for example, I don't mean to be too contentious here, but I believe that if you've got a working situation where, you know, one person employs many others and where that person has a right to fire at will, without any negotiation with, you know, a tribunal body or a union for that matter, or without any legal hurdles to cross, he's just able to fire at will in a world where there's, you know, high unemployment and being fired is a very serious sort of a loss to anybody. When that person, the employer, has that sort of power in relation to an employee, then I think that's a case where the employee is really not going to be able to look the employer in the eye without reason for fear or deference. In fact, being aware of that situation, the employee in such a case is going to have every reason in the world, every motive in the world, in the old 17th century language, to fawn and toady, you know, to kowtow and tip the cap or whatever it might be. I think that that's not a good way of organizing our employment, our workplace relations, for example, if it induces that failure of the eyeball test in the workplace. But, of course, there are many places in social life apart from the workplace. There's the public place, there's the family place, of course, the home. And in all of these areas, I think it's important that there be protections in place, many of them legal, many of them cultural, such that everyone really has got his or her own space and is able to look others equally in the eye.
In the realm of government and freedom from the domination of the government, the test is tough luck.
The tough luck test,
yes. Yeah. Explain that.
Yes, I'm not sure that this is quite as intuitive as the eyeball mm-hmm. test, but myself, I actually find it fairly persuasive. So it goes like this. If I live in a society where there are, say, we've all got a vote and so on. We're all able to contest what happens. We're all able to write to our Member of Parliament. We're all able to join some NGO to protest on one or another front against what government is doing, to have some influence. We're all able to join a demonstration, whatever it is. If we live in a society where first of all, we have those personal powers shared with our fellow citizens, and again, we live in a society where what happens in the higher echelons, so to speak, the corridors of power, the various bureau and so on, and the various courtrooms, for that matter, and tribunals, are subject to what we think of as an impartial sort of rule where no one's interests, not the interests of the wealthy, not the interests of a particular religion or whatever, no one's special interests have particular force. Everyone is more or less well represented, interests in general well represented. Then you'll be in the following situation, that when the government or the legislature passes a law, of course, this is a legislature you've helped elect and is responsive to you and to fellow citizens equally. When they pass a law and you really believe of this system, that you are equally represented with others in this system, and that those in your neck of the woods, your corner of society, are not particularly suppressed or whatever, not particularly second-rate citizens, then what you're going to believe about a piece of legislation, even when it goes against you, so perhaps the government introduces a measure in taxation that doesn't particularly go down well with you or those in your particular area in the economy, for example, you should be able to think of the fact that this legislation goes against your particular interests. You should be able to think that, well, you know, I believe in our system. I think I'm equally represented with others in that system. So I can think about this as it's hard, it's tough, but it's just tough luck. It's not that somebody has got it in for me. It's not that there's a power in government, you know, that is representing other sectors of society more strongly than mine, so that really what's happening to me is a result of the fact that government is in the control of another section of the community. No, rather, government is responsive to all the sides of the community. And so I'm able to think about what government does, even when it acts in a way that's not welcome to me, as that's just tough luck. Now, I think if we had a society where you could think about legislation that even ran against your wishes, that it was just tough luck, that's a good sign that you're living in a society where the government, the source of law and order and so on in the society, is a government that's responsive to you equally with others, so that no one of you is dominated by that government as by an independent agency. It's an agency that is responsive to each of you equally with others. You've got to live with others. That's part of the human condition. And so you're not dominated insofar as that government has that sort of responsiveness to all.
And with regard to global justice, what is the catchphrase there?
The catchphrase there is straight talking. Mm-hmm. Imagine the relationship between the Ukrainian government and the Russian government as of now, where, for example, the Russian government clearly have got troops on the border or in the precincts of the border and clearly have a deep influence over the people in eastern Ukraine and are able to turn off the gas at any point. The relationship between those two governments is clearly one of domination. I mean, the Ukrainian government is in a situation where they really, other forces absent, would have to kowtow and toady and fawn and so on, would really not be free in relation to that other government. Now, of course, it's a very unstable and unhappy situation. The fact that the European Union and that the United States is, to a good extent, backing the Ukrainians can give them a certain sort of boost and maybe restore some degree of equality in that relationship. But it's still very problematic. Now, I think in relationships general between states, we have to think, first of all, let's imagine we're talking about states that are, if not perfect democracies, and I actually believe very few states are anything near perfect in terms of the ideal of political justice, right? In almost every country, government is often subject to the special influence of particular groups who control government, so people really don't enjoy full political freedom in relation to the government. But imagine for a moment that we have got states where we're not complaining about them domestically. They're politically okay. So what would it be to establish relations between these states such that no one society would be dominated by others or dominated by multinational agencies? Now, this is a really big challenge. I mean, your own area of interest is international relations, so you'll be very sensitive to this because, of course, states differ enormously in power, in military power, in economic power, in cultural power, in diplomatic clout. They differ in enormous respects. So it's a real challenge there. Now, I think that it is very important from the point of view of countries that they're not dominated, because if they are by another country, that impacts in turn on the residents, the citizens of that country. They become sort of second-rate citizens in the global order. So I think we really should work towards this sort of ideal. It's another question about how we can begin to achieve anything like that ideal. Now, I think international agencies like the United Nations and the various bodies of the United Nations, they are really absolutely crucial. And one of the very sad things that I see happening nowadays is a sort of withdrawal of trust from these international organizations and bodies on the grounds that they're suffering a democratic deficit, as it's often put. I think that's way overstated. These bodies, after all, are subject to the control of the governments who appoint the officials and so on. And those officials and international law, international regulations, international standards, which are, you know, hammered out over tables where countries are represented. I think that that's the only hope of establishing an international order where when the leaders of countries talk to one another, they can talk straight, you know. They don't have to be mealy-mouthed on the one hand or speak with the tones of a master on the other.
It strikes me that your definition of freedom, through its simplicity and its application across domains, helps save freedom as a virtue, as a value, for progressive ideals, in the sense that you're not saying that the state should do nothing, because you're also saying I can't be equal with you unless, yes, you know, my position, their programs or policies, if I'm in poverty, that elevate me to be your equal if you're not in a similar situation. So the virtue of what you're saying and its distinction from libertarianism on the one hand and its emphasis on structure on the other allows freedom to have a new constituency, shall we say, in terms of the divisions that occur in our country.
Absolutely. I mean, I think the tradition and the ideas are of interest on all sides of politics. But my own thinking about what's required for giving substance and life to this ideal of freedom, freedom as non-domination, in these three different areas, leads me to support very much very progressive policies. And I think they are quite different from the policies in general that libertarians would support. So I'll give you an example. Take the workplace example. I mean, libertarians will always insist on the right to fire at will. It's one of the basics of libertarian demands. But you give the right to fire at will to an employer and you immediately create an asymmetry between employer and employee. It's standard libertarian line to decry unions, for example. Well, I must say I deeply regret the loss of union power, because while corporations, unions have never been angels, I mean, they've always had their own problems. The same is true of corporations. And what's happening with the decline of unions is that you don't have a countervailing power against the power of corporations in dealing with employees, which means in turn, of course, that the employees more and more get into a position where they're dominated. Or take a situation of, for example, I think it's very important that welfare legislation be in place, including national health and or some form of national health, public health system, So that people aren't put in the position of having to depend on the grace and goodwill of their betters and the wealthier. Now, libertarian doctrine will always tell you philanthropy. That's what we want, more and more philanthropy. Now, I believe philanthropy is a great thing, and well organized, it can be a force for, you know, unalloyed good. But the idea that someone should depend on the pro bono favor of doctors, family they happen to know or whatever, in order to get proper medical treatment, I mean, I know that doesn't happen, but just take that as a commonly, but that is really anathema to the idea of freedom that we're talking about, because it means that the person who's ill has got to depend on the grace and favor of the local doctor who's not going to charge a fee or whatever it is. You've got to have an infrastructure of protection in society in order to ensure that people are going to enjoy the capacity that will give them, enable them to pass the eyeball test. And I think one thing that's worth saying here, if I can add, Harry, is that in libertarian thought, it's often suggested that we have a natural order, which is an order of ownership and the market. But that's not a natural order. That's created by law. You know, property only exists in virtue of a law. If we're in a state of nature and I hold on to this, I can possess it, you know, and you can't take it from me. But it doesn't exist as property unless we have a law that basically says that the forces of the community are going to rally behind me. If you try to take it from me, they're going to support my claim. Law creates property. Law equally creates and, of course, facilitates markets. And that's a great thing. I mean, I'm a great believer in markets. This is by no means some sort of neo-Marxist view or anything. But just as law creates property and ownership and the market, it's perfectly fine that law should be there to enable and facilitate people to enjoy the basics, the basic requirements of life, as in welfare legislation, to enjoy, for example, assurance of legal representation if they are brought before the courts, whether privately or by the government in criminal charge, to enjoy an assurance about their medical, recourse to medical help in the case of necessity and so on. All of these are essential infrastructure if you're going to have freedom as non-domination enjoyed in the social sphere within a given society.
You were part of an extraordinary experiment, shall we say, in which a new Spanish prime minister about a decade ago had read your book, an earlier book on civic republicanism, invited you to be part of a process of the implementation of new policies. And if I can summarize briefly because of the time, you address the parliament with laying out the ideals of republicanism. And then after the government existed and was implementing these policies, you actually did a report card for the government on how the policies were being implemented in the different provinces. The tire really hit the road, theory interfaced with practice. What did you see in that whole process? What did you learn that informed your understanding of civic republicanism at that time?
Well, the story, just to fill in a little bit, was that Mr. Zapatero, when he became leader of the Socialist Party in Spain, was looking for a philosophy. He had this view that as a government, as he hoped to become the government, of course, he would have a general philosophy of government, what it was about, what law was about, what policymaking was about. And he came upon my book. He read widely, apparently, and he decided that this was where he wanted to go. And I had known in the early 2000s, I heard from friends in Spain about my name being used and the book being used and so on. And then in 2004, he was elected. And he, at that stage, invited me to give a lecture in Madrid in a very large forum, actually, with a lot of politicians and ministers and so on and government there by invitation to talk about this Republican philosophy, which he had espoused and espoused the book, so to speak, as he said, is his vade mecum, you know, that he brought with him. And I gave that lecture, and he was to respond to it. But in the course of the lecture, I turned to him in a slightly jokey way. And I said, well, look, he'd been just 3 months in power, but one thing he had done, which I supported in the book, was to make the national broadcaster independent of government. Up to that point, the national broadcaster, apparently, a minister could say, I want to be on the 6 o'clock news, or I want to be there when I'm opening a supermarket, you know, I want to report. And the broadcaster did the favor. He made the broadcaster into like a BBC, independent of government. And I thought this was a terrific idea. I think it's really important that you have an independent broadcaster. Maybe not necessarily of that kind, but certainly like public broadcasting and so on. I turned to him and I said, no, you've done this and I think this is wonderful. But I said, it's very easy to be a philosopher like me, but you're going to, you know, lead one of the largest economies in the world, the ninth largest economy in the world. And I said, you're going to find, for example, the national broadcaster is going to be your worst critic on some fronts. And you're going to find it really hard not to pick up that phone and remind them, you know, about how much they are in your debt and try to sort of influence them. That will be a real temptation. I don't have that temptation. You're going to have that. And I explained that, as I thought, it would be very, very hard to live up to the principles of this way of thinking, this neo-Republican way of thinking. And in his response to me, he basically gave up the comments he was going to make, I think, and he invited me publicly. He insisted he was absolutely committed to running with this program and these policies, these ideas, and he invited me to do a report on his government, which I would publicize 6 months before the next election, which is due 4 years later. And someone in the audience immediately stood up, who was the head of a foundation in Spain, and said that this foundation will support Professor Pettit's work and bring him back and so on to give the report. And actually, it wasn't at all the sort of thing I had as an ambition to do, or even an inclination really to do. I could see straight away the hard work that was going to be involved in reading what was happening and so on. But I agreed to do it. Sometimes people say that I advised that government. I didn't advise the government. They very nicely asked if I would be, but I said there'd be a conflict of interest, of course, if I'm doing a report. But over that 4 years, they brought in various policies, and I talked on a number of occasions with Zapatero. I had one particularly long interview with him where he sought to persuade me that these policies were, in fact, motivated by the principles of this neo-Republican way of thinking. And then I presented the report in about 4 months before the election in 2007.
Well, on that note, there's a limit with our time constraints that we can cover. But let me recommend your book to our audience because it's beautifully written, and it's an opportunity to explore this idea of freedom that is kind of different from what we normally hear, at least in the United States. Thank you very much, Professor Pettit, for coming here today. And thank you very much for joining us for this conversation with history.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.